You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the 12th to the 18th of June 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, books editor Karen Shook, reporters David Matthews and Jack Grove. The number of complaints about universities reaching the Office of the Independent Adjudicator has fallen for the first time in the Ombudsman's history. But why? More on that shortly. In fewer than 100 days' time, Scottish voters will decide whether the country is to become independent from the UK or not. But what does this mean for universities? That's the question asked in this week's cover feature, which is written by David, and he'll tell us a bit more about it shortly. Mammon's Kingdom, an essay on Britain, is this week's book of the week, reviewed by Danny Dorling. More on that and indeed the rest of the book section soon. And would you be happy if you had to teach a class at 9 o'clock? That's 9 p.m, by the way, not 9 a.m. Find out which university could be asking staff to do just that. But first, complaints to the HE sector's ombudsman have fallen for the first time, Jack. Why is that? The 9K fees regime was supposed to usher in a generation of picky and demanding students. Why are they seemingly complaining less?
Well, the complaints that reached the OIA are those that universities haven't been able to sort out themselves. Students are still unhappy, and in that situation they have the opportunity to go to this independent body that can sort things out. And it seems that although complaints may be creeping upwards in total, universities are actually getting better at sorting them out before they go, before they reach the OIA. So for the first time since 2005, when the OIA was set up, the actual number of cases they're dealing with has gone down, which is good news, really.
Mm-hmm. So it's better internal processes, really. It's not fewer dissatisfied people. It's just that their complaints are being nipped in the bud, perhaps before they're allowed to escalate.
Well, that's what some people say, but there is the other view that maybe with so many complaints, universities are maybe bowing to student pressure a bit more, and they're just sort of saying, well, you know, we're going to sort this out and sort of maybe accede to a request that we may have stood firm on. Obviously, that's conjecture, but there's all these things going on, and the OIA is quite an interesting body because it's adjudicating all these things, and it's quite critical of universities in some ways, and it points out that it's helped settle various cases of a part-time student whose fees doubled from one year to the next, and an international student who had to go home because he wasn't told he had to get another visa, and also a student who wasn't allowed to graduate or had to graduate later because the university withheld his degree because of an outstanding accommodation fee and things like that. The OIA step in and they say, you know, this is not on. But overall, it's quite hard to say exactly what's happening. But I think it seems like that complaints are going in the right direction.
Surprising in a way, isn't it? Because there was quite a high-profile story from the BBC last week, wasn't there, showing the number of student complaints received by universities was 10% higher. This sort of flies in the face of that.
It does. I mean, the thing about that BBC story is that the 20,000 figure it quoted included academic appeals as well as complaints. And academic appeals, if they've gone up, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It could just be that universities are you know, making their systems more transparent and open to students, so it allows them to appeal things, or, you know, so things like that. It's not necessarily a bad thing. So, I mean, it's interesting. Well, I'm not quite sure that 20,000 figure tells the whole story.
Sure. Well, that full story is on page 6 and 7 this week. Our cover feature, however, is all about the independence referendum in Scotland. David, you've been speaking to people on both sides of this debate about what it means for higher education.
Yes, that's right. It's not long to go till people decide whether Scotland becomes independent or not, and it will probably have pretty significant consequences for higher education, so we've taken a really in-depth and long-term look into what it might mean. Because we've had lots of debate over the kind of immediate issues that will be up for negotiation. So whether Scotland will be able to keep its free tuition fees policy, and also whether they continue to remain part of UK research councils. Sort of put that in a box and looked at, you know, what would happen in sort of 20, 30 years' time? What's the kind of direction of travel? Because after all, for lots of universities, that's actually, in terms of their history, that's over quite a long time. Some of the sort of supporters of independence, you know, are really quite hopeful about what it could lead to in Scottish universities. They see it as potentially triggering a kind of de-corporatisation of universities and give more power over to academics. And there was a report by Ferdinand von Prondinsky, who's VC of Glasgow Caledonian, sorry, Robert Gordon University, I should
say. In Aberdeen,
say. Yeah. And he, in 2012, set up all these quite radical proposals to have 40% of governing boards made up of women, and to have more student staff representatives on those boards. And, you know, there's this sort of underlying feeling that if you had an independent Scotland, you'd be able to turn away from the kind of maybe slightly money, fees-obsessed culture in England and get back to a kind of something where, that, as von Brodnitsky puts it, intellectual objectives are foremost. But then you've got other people who think this idea is just a sort of romantic fantasy, basically, and they say, you know, universities are successful as they are at the moment because not everything is decided by academics, but it's because they are run more like companies and the power of senators have been diminished. There's other issues as well. So, and I think generally both supporters and people who don't support independence believe that the government will probably take a tighter rein over research priorities in independent Scotland and more tightly focus research to kind of boosting the Scottish economy. So that's, you know, I guess that's a good or a bad thing depending on
your research interests.
Well, exactly, yeah. If you're researching something like renewable energy, you might get masses of money chucked at you. But if you're not in an area deemed important to the Scottish economy, who knows, you could have funding cuts. The other issue that really came out of this piece, researching this piece, is the amazing sort of fear of people not wanting to go on record with lots of their concerns and actual views on independence. I mean, people fearing that, you know, in an independent Scotland there'll be blackballed in their academic careers because they opposed it, or other people thinking the same thing but the other way around, thinking that, you know, the university establishment is generally pro-union and they'll be punished for coming out in favour of yes. And we also discuss in here, and also in John Gill's Leader this week, we also ask, you know, why haven't university heads in Scotland, why haven't they given their views on whether it will be good or bad for universities? I mean, that their view is always, that they always say, I mean, with some justification, you know, if they set out a view, it will be construed as a university's view and they've got to remain neutral in all of this. But they must have a view. I mean, which way it is, and they must have a view. And so, why aren't they expressing it? I mean, they're perfectly happy to express their views on the European Union. So, a group of vice chancellors from.
I suppose it's the equivalent of expressing a view for a political party, though, isn't it? Almost, because you could never, as a VC, say, come out explicitly for Labour or Conservative Party, yet this is effectively coming out explicitly for the SNP, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. It's a big kind of constitutional, big long-term issue, isn't it? Like the EU, and you know, there's lots of people in sort of Scottish Labour who are pro yes. So it's not. Obviously, the SNP are leading the independence campaign, but I don't know if it's totally neatly split down party lines. And I guess you could argue if a party has really good policies or really bad policies for higher education, you should be able to come out for or against that.
Yeah, so I suppose so.
We're looking at, you know, what would happen, but also the state of the debate around the independence vote.
And one VC in Scotland told me there was no part of the spectrum you could place yourself on that would impress more people than it would offend, and therefore there was absolutely no way he was going to be drawn on the question.
It's a ramifications point, isn't it, as David said before?
Yeah. The SNP will still be powerful even if no wins, basically, so you don't want to get on the wrong side.
Indeed. Page 34 for that in-depth feature this week. Our books section is always in-depth. Karen, what's in store this week?
This week we have Vernon Bogdanore talking about Stephen Fielding's book A State of Play, British Politics on Screen, Stage and Page, from Anthony Trollope to the Thick of It. And of course, Vernon, famously not only an extremely eminent scholar of politics, but also David Cameron's tutor, so he knows a bit about politics when he sees it in the flesh. Also this week we have Hakim Adi from the University of Chichester reviewing a book by Saladin Ambar, Malcolm X at Oxford Union, Racial Politics in a Global Era, one of the last public speeches by Malcolm X, of course, on the 3rd of December 1964 at Oxford Union. Also this week we have Tara Shears, an experimental particle physicist at the University of Liverpool, who also spends some of her time at CERN, talking about a book by John Moffat, Cracking the Particle Code of the Universe, The Hunt for the Higgs Boson. There have been a flood of books about this subject, obviously. However, John Moffat is well known for someone who thought that there was not going to be a Higgs boson and is a bit of a controversialist, I suppose one would say, in the world of physics. So it makes for a particularly interesting reading. At our Book of the Week this week, Danny Dorling, the Halford Mackinder Professor of Human Geography at the University of Oxford, reviews a book by an eminent historian, author, and former Labour MP, David Marquand, Mammon's Kingdom, an essay on Britain now. Marquand famously left the Labour Party with Roy Hattersley to go on to work in the European Commission and then later in the SDP. And Danny says, it's precisely its author's lack of radicalism that makes Mammon's Kingdom so powerful. What's being asked for here is simply reasonable, not revolutionary. It's, I guess, a polemic in favor of curtailing the power of the banks, of the forces that are making the UK uniquely, Marquand argues, in thrall to money worship. Dorling points out, of course, that although you would expect these kinds of arguments from many other quarters, the fact that it has been being made by someone like David Marquand indicates the extent to which this idea has now been mainstreamed.
Interesting stuff. And a reminder that there's plenty of books podcasts as well upon the site in the podcast section, and more to come soon, I'm promised as well.
So I will be speaking to David Marquand next week.
Very, very good. Finally, teaching at 9 p.m. in the evening doesn't sound like a walk in the park to me. Simon, which university is suggesting this, and how's it gone down with staff?
Well, often the sort of discussion is about students and whether they can make it in for a 9 a.m. lecture. But it seems that a proposal that's being consulted on at Exeter could see sort of lectures given up until kind of 9 p.m. I think that would be the finish time, really. So, we're not saying that you'd start a lecture at 9 p.m. Sure, but 8 p.m. would still be seen as quite late, I suppose, by students who may argue they had other things to do, and certainly by lecturers who might find that difficult to fit around their kind of private lives, really. So the reason for this is that Exeter has been one of the universities that's hugely expanded its undergraduate intake, especially following the sort of move to lift caps on numbers for those students with good A-levels. But it's obviously the ramifications of that is that it's potentially finding it difficult to fit in all its teaching sessions. And so three kind of proposals have been put forward there. One to sort of extend the timetable to 7 p.m. 3 days a week. Another to start teaching at 8 a.m. and finish at 6:30 3 days a week, or finish at 9 p.m. on a Thursday. And it's kind of stressed that staff working that late on that day would be able to come in later, but it doesn't seem to have gone. Although there's no official comment from the UCU there yet, it doesn't appear to have a great deal of support. So It's going to it be interesting to see how that plays out. But it's another example of kind of how, I suppose, there is more of a move towards a kind of 24-hour type culture, and not just sort of generally in employment, and not just in universities as well. But I suspect that it might be quite difficult to push through with this idea of the 9 p.m. finish, but I think they're more likely to go for, if they did any of those things, you might have a slightly earlier start and finished at 6:30, you know. But yeah, it throws up all the usual questions about flexible working hours and whether that discriminates against people that have got family lives,
for example.
I know that in under the Athena Swan, they don't like, which is an inequality initiative, they don't like departmental meeting to start at 4 o'clock or later, because that means that basically women with children have to, you know, basically they just want to get the meeting over and done with so they can get back and start their evening. So
I guess anyone with childcare,
exactly.
Responsibilities, so, men as well.
Men as well. So, you know, these things do have. It seems like, well, the people that I spoke to, they were saying that this change is going to have sort of knock on consequences that they should have to pay the price for the university expanding in such an aggressive way.
Interesting stuff. Well, page 7 for that story this week. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've spoken about, or indeed any articles in the magazine, you'll find us at timeshighereducation.co.uk, also on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Google+. Also, do check out our YouTube channel. There's been a few videos added to that recently, including a couple taken from Universities Week, which is ongoing as we record this, so do check that out too. But until next week, that's all from the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.